think I can handle it?
Very good then, Mr. McGinnis. Welcome to my world.
Gathered together from the cosmic reaches of the universe, here in this great hall of justice.
Welcome, everybody. Episode 30 of the Hall of Justice. Can you believe it? We have 30 episodes. We have had peaks and valleys. I have had one of these podcasts that has only had 40 listeners, and I've had one that has over 100,000 listeners. Today's podcast will fall somewhere in the middle, I'm sure. It's going to have more than 40. I don't think it'll have 100,000. I start with a little bit of thanks. I really want to thank everyone for subscribing, for the reviews. It's been really great. I know a lot of people found the podcast from Zack Snyder, but then we had Jay Oliva, and Jay was great, and there was a great response to that. I really appreciate that. This is a labor of love. This is so much fun, but I take this very seriously. We have done a show. If you've gone back through the episodes, we have done a show that is considered nerddom. I don't call it nerd. I don't call it geek talk. I don't like that. I'm sorry to the folks at Con Radio, which simulcast the podcast, because they call themselves radio for geeks. I'm not a geek. If I need to, I can document the amount of women I have been with. I will justify that I am not a nerd. However, I do appreciate that sometimes the subject matter gets of a nerdy nature. We did 4 podcasts on Star Wars. We've done things on Supergirl. We've done stuff on The Flash. We've talked about a lot of different subjects. I was approached in a very unique way. One of the people at Blog Talk Radio tipped me off to this idea. And the idea for today's show comes from somebody just offering this to me, and then I had to find this person. This is like an episode of Where's Waldo? Finding Molly Reynolds was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I had to use LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, this thing, that thing, these reporter nonsense. I had to, like, it was harder. It is probably easier to get Henry Cavill on the show than it would be getting Molly Reynolds. Nonetheless, we found Molly Reynolds, and she has an interesting take. She is a blogger for the Huffington Post. She's a columnist for Inc. We'll get her to tell you all about those. She also works with TradePoint, where she's executive vice president. But she has an interesting take, and it had to do with the subject of one of the new Netflix series, Jessica Jones. Jessica Jones is a great show. I'm just saying that right there. It's a great show. But it is different than most superhero shows in that it brings up themes that I find to be fascinating. I love the idea that they could take a goofy comic book character called the Purple Man and turn him into a psycho thriller named Kilgrave. I found what they had done very unique. And there was a theme, the way it was presented to me, there was a theme that people who are victims of assault would actually find some level of inspiration from Jessica Jones. That floored me. That idea is unique because that's not what Superman and Batman and Spider-Man usually do. Yes, as kids, we dream about having those costumes. Is there actually a female superhero in the modern media that can inspire victims that have been victimized in similar ways that Kilgrave victimized his attackees? There is that possibility, and that is the subject of today's show. I am so honored to welcome in Molly Reynolds. Molly, first of all, is this really you? Did I really find you? And I have to say, thank you so much for doing the show.
You did find me, and I'm really glad that you did, Seth. I'm excited to be on the show and talk about this issue. It's really important to me.
You had done some research because you wrote an article for Huffington Post. How did you come across Jessica Jones? Before we get into your background, because I want to give you the platform to do it, how did you come across Jessica Jones? How was that show introduced to you?
Well, I work in the media. I am a journalist, but I also have worked in PR and media relations. And one of my friends called me, and I hadn't heard from him in a long time. And he called, and I had been up for a writing job for a very specific magazine. And he said, you know, that's really cool. I have an idea for you. You should write about Jessica Jones. I keep watching that show and I can't stop thinking about you. And I said, I've never seen it. And he said, oh my God, you've not heard of it? And I said, well, everyone says my boyfriend looks like Luke Cage, but other than that, I have no idea what it's about. And he said, well, I mean, it's clearly about emotional abuse. And it's really incredibly written. And, you know, I couldn't help but think of your personal story. And I was married for 8 years in a very, very abusive relationship. And I had no idea that I was in a, quote, domestic abuse situation because I was very, very young. And I was also an executive. And, no, you know, you're talking about geeks. I am considered a geek. I specialize in tech media. My clients are, you know, marketing automation softwares and payment processing technologies, and you know, and I cover these people, and so people have considered me as being like this very brainy person, and how could you ever be in a situation like that or be controlled by somebody else? And I have to say, over the last 5 years of being out of the marriage, I happily forgot about it. I have a really wonderful partner and a really nice life and really great friends and family. And this phone call from my friend just, he mentioned the emotional abuse, and I was like, I don't want to write about that. I'll check out the show. He made me promise to check out Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones.
Yeah. And so, you know, David, my boyfriend, he was out of the house, and I, you know, got cozy with the kitty and made a snack and watched the first episode. And I knew that it was coming. Like, I knew that the theme of emotional abuse was coming. But I wasn't prepared for how it hit me. And I left the first episode in tears. And, you know, I wasn't expecting it, and the way that they did it was absolutely beautiful, but it really hit me in a very, very hard way.
The uniqueness, the uniqueness of this story, before we get into then dissecting what Jessica Jones is, talk to me a little bit about how you were in an abusive relationship and didn't know it. I've never been in an abusive relationship. I have never abused somebody, so I can't say that I have a working knowledge of this. I would think, just as a layman, I would think that if you're in an abusive relationship, you know. How did you not know?
Well, I was a professional actor when I was a kid, and I...
Were you in anything we would know?
No, it was mostly theater. Theater, okay. And sometimes ballet. And okay. I was sort of primed to do well. My parents were working class. They didn't have any money, but I had gotten scholarships for music and acting. And I skipped 2 grades in high school because I was working and because I had a 4.0 and I tested out of high school. Mm. So I was, wow. You know, like Hope on the show, very, very focused on this dream. And
So Hope is the girl you, for those of you who have seen Jessica Jones, Hope is the girl you align yourself with, not Jessica, correct?
It's both in different ways.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
So Hope, when I was young, but I'm 33 now, So Hope really hit me, especially in that first episode, and she was the one that really devastated me when I watched it, because she was ambitious and on top of her game for her age. And, you know, who knew that a girl like that would fall victim to an older British man the same way I did? Mine was also British. That, you know, you're at this part in your life where you kind of, you're 18, 19 years old, and you think you're an adult. And for me, I was out of my parents' house. I was making my own money. I never asked my parents for money. I never asked them for help because I was a grown-up. And so I met this man who was 11 years older than me. And despite being ambitious, I was very insecure. And I was also sheltered by a really nice family. It didn't occur to me that somebody that said that he loved me would not have my best interests. So it was a combination of being insecure, being out of my own at a very young age. And he was the first person I fell in love with. And I just didn't see that the abuse turns up over time. You know, at first it starts where they, you know, they tell you you're the most incredible person in the world. They what they call, which what I later found out is called love bombing, where they, you know, they tell you how great you are and they build you up. But then certain things will creep into the conversation later, like, you really shouldn't wear that top because you look like you are flirting with people. And for me, coming from a friendly family and just being a nice person, you know, trying to be a nice person most of the time, I would get, he would accuse me of flirting with people. And it would, you know, like certain guys would think that I was, and I wasn't. I was just trying to be interested, like in a conversation. And because it was like, it was confusing, because I thought, well, I must be doing this. I must be giving the wrong impression. But then he caused me to think that I was, you know, playing him, or, you know, that I was messing with his heart, and it made me feel bad. And so I was constantly apologizing for things that I didn't even really do. And it, you know, it starts off where you think, oh, this must be love. He's so mad at me. I must have really messed up. And then it turns up to bigger, scarier things, where they start making you question your memory. And, you know, where you're sure that you didn't do something, but they're so adamant that you did, that you get discombobulated. And that is also, I learned later, a characteristic of an abuser. And before I knew it, I was married to him. He needed a green card. And I married him because I loved him and I didn't want him to leave. But then pretty soon things turned up, and
was that true? Was he lying to you?
Was he lying about
needing the green card, or did he have other options, or were you his only hope?
He was very handsome and very suave, and so women were kind of all over him. And so I'm not quite sure why it was me. I don't know if he loved me in those early days or not, or if I was easy to manipulate because I was young. But there were a lot of lies. He was an actor, and he said he was here on a specific visa, which is an actor visa. And I later found out that he was not on that. One of my aunts is a detective, and she background checked him and found out that he was not on that visa. But by that point, we were already married. And because I was at that weird age where you're 19, 20 years old, you're still a kid in your mind. You know, you don't know a lot, but I was an adult technically. So my family really couldn't do anything, because he wouldn't actually hit me. He would hit next to me. He would hit the wall next to me, as if to intimidate you into saying, like, next time it's going to be you. But the other confusing thing about it was that to the neighbors and the people in the community, he was the nicest man. Everybody just thought he was so nice. And they never saw that very, very angry side of him. And I thought, there must be something wrong with me because I'm the only one that makes him so angry. I tried to leave a few times, and that's when he would smash the walls or smash glasses or things like that. He caused me to believe that I was not a good actor. It didn't even occur to me. I've been working for 10 years at this point, and I got these scholarships, but I had saved up this money to move to New York, and he needed that money, and he convinced me that I was not ready or not good enough to do that, and ended up, he took that money and spent it on a car, and then I just found myself in this weird place where I was like, all of a sudden, like, working two full-time jobs, one at an old folks' home in the middle of the night, one at a production company during the day, and he convinced me to sell my eggs to infertile couples for money. He was spending money as soon as I was making it, and I was hyped up on hormones the whole time because when you donate your eggs, they make you take hormones for 3 weeks, and it kind of alters your state of mind. Anyone who's ever been in menopause would ever know, because that's the way that it does. You forget things, you cry a lot.
No, but people are hearing this and they watch Jessica Jones. They're saying, this guy has a power.
Yes, yes. And that was the thing. It was like through the brainwashing of a young sheltered girl, he convinced me my family was not good for me, that my family was trying to keep me young, or they wanted me to be this famous actress, and that if I disappointed them, they would stop loving me, and that's not real love, and that's not how my family is at all. But that's why the hope in the first episode. Should I be worried about giving away what happens?
No. Spoilers are over by now. I mean, they're talking about the second season already.
Yeah, okay.
No.
If you haven't watched it, I'm sorry, but she.
I told you weren't allowed to come on the show unless you saw the whole thing. So
yeah, you saw the whole thing. So when Hope kills her parents,
that's the first episode.
Yeah, it hit me in a hard way because obviously I did not kill my parents, but metaphorically I did because I cut them off, and they were wonderful people, and I always had it in the back of my mind that someday after everything was fixed, we would all be a family again. But 1 year turned into 5 years, turned into 8 years, and that's when I kind of grew up and left him. After the hormones subsided and I was thinking straight. But it was difficult. And in the midst of this, because he didn't work, he told me that it was hard for him to get a job being a foreigner. But really it was because he didn't want to work. And I almost died in the hospital from one of the egg donations. And
wow.
It turns out I had a condition, and I what they call hyperstimulated, but it was to a point where I was not able to pee, and I was highly dehydrated. It was scary. Wow. And so he left me in the hospital. He took the check and left me in the hospital. And I met my first boss, who gave me, oddly enough, she saw this like kid in a hospital by herself. He didn't allow me to call my parents. It was back in the days before cell phones. And I was kind of at my wit's end. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't even know if I was going to live. And after I got out of the hospital, this woman I met gave me a job. And I eventually, it was a job writing ads. And I eventually became a marketing director. I had one successful startup under my belt, then two, then three. And by the third one, I was the chief marketing officer of a large surgery center. And kind of known as like this, you know, woman that doesn't take any shit from anybody. And, right. You know, people were shocked to know that I was in this situation because I was an executive, and you know, this who they perceived as being this powerful person. I was during the day, but then I'd go home at night and be completely controlled by him. He spent all the money. He would constantly, like, there was one time where a man came by the house. And I guess I had lost my wallet and I didn't realize it. And he called me at work furious. This was like the beginning of the end. He called me at work furious and he said, "Some man came by the house with all of your things. Who is he?" And I said, "What do you mean all of my things?" And he just exploded. Yeah. And he's like, "All of your things." And he goes, and I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And he was just, "Oh my God, you make me so angry." He's like, your credit card, your driver's license, you know, like, and he started listing things that were in my wallet. And I said, "Oh, like my wallet?" And I checked my pockets and I was like, "Oh, I guess I dropped it." And he's like demanding who this man is. And I said, "I don't know. He won't even tell me what he looks like." And he goes, he was sure that I was sleeping with him. And he said, "If I were you, I wouldn't come home tonight." And it was that fear of what will happen when I come home. And then by that point, I was cut off from, I had no friends. Like my family, I was embarrassed to call them. There was nothing. And I was old enough to where I started thinking, I didn't do anything wrong. I had always, anytime something like that would happen and I was younger, I would blame myself and go, "Oh gosh, maybe, you know, you're discombobulated. So you start thinking you are wrong." And by this point I was 28 years old and I was tired and I just went, "I actually didn't do anything." And, eventually I stood up to him, and it was because I wrote something that I wrote a piece, a musical that people were really excited about. And I started not caring if he thought that I had friends or that, you know, that maybe I was doing something outside of him. And I believe he was cheating on me with somebody else at the time because this woman kept calling the house. And I think he was more concerned with her during this point. So I just kept carrying on what I was doing. And he got furious that I had created these friendships with men that I was not interested in, but that were just my friends. One of them was from my college, you know, and we had reconnected. And he came to the performance and stormed out in the middle and created this scene. And like I always do, I lied and, you know, I lied to people when my friends had said, "Why did he walk out of the middle of this?" And I said, "Oh, he had a meeting. It's okay." And they said, "It's Sunday." "No, we didn't. Why did he leave?" And I finally just spilled my guts to them about everything that had happened. And they urged me to leave, but I said, "No, you have to work things out in a marriage. I'm going to work it out, but I'm going to get what I want this time." And I came back home, and for the next 10 days, I didn't eat. We constantly fought. He wanted me to get pregnant and move 3 hours away from anybody that I was connected with. He wanted me to get a new job in Valencia, if you know California.
I mean, this sounds like a movie.
So, yeah.
And I knew about this, folks. Folks, I talked to her before. She's doing more now than I thought. This is it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's weird to talk about now because it's so not my life now. But
is it therapeutic to talk about?
You know, People have asked me that before. I wrote a musical about this that went to the New York Musical Theater Festival, and then I wrote this story, which trended on AOL for a while. And people have asked me, you know, is it cathartic to get all of this out? And I said, back when I was sort of, when it was still fresh in my mind, I went, no, this is awful. I hate talking about this, especially when it went on AOL. I got a lot of really positive support from people, but then I also got people going, well, he was right. What's wrong with you, you stupid bitch? And so I was going, there's nothing about this that's cathartic.
Oh, because the internet is such a nice
place. It is. but as I've started working with victims of domestic abuse, because I did, right after I wrote the musical, and I was informed that I was in an abusive relationship by some therapists happened to be in the audience, or people that deal with emotional abuse or domestic abuse. And they said, wow, you know, you really did your research on domestic abuse. And I said, no, this isn't a play about domestic abuse. This is just a love story that went wrong. And they're like, no, it's not. And they were the ones that told me. And so I went after that. I was just, you know, still in kind of a bad place. And I went to kind of pay it forward, I guess. And I volunteered at a domestic abuse shelter. And, you know, they started asking me questions about my past. And they said, were you a victim? And I said, well, no, not really. It's all emotional. I didn't get hit. Nothing like you guys. And they, both of them had been through terrible, terrible domestic abuse situations. One of them, she lost her hearing because he hit her so hard. And she said, the emotional part is way worse than getting hit. Yeah. And it's terrifying. And that's actually the gateway to what leads somebody to accept getting hit.
So can I steer this in just one direction? And by all means, I'm not taking anything. You can say literally whatever you want. When you found the support group for victims of Kilgrave, what emotions did you see when you saw that?
It was so powerful to me because there were people of all different walks of life. There were strong men, there were women, there were children even that Kilgrave affected. And
then Jessica doesn't want to do it.
And Jessica doesn't want to do it, and I completely related to that because I think the reason I relate to that character so much is that she and I have the same coping mechanism where we just go, no, I'm not a victim. I'm not going to do that. The flashbacks that she has were very similar to things that I've had. It's almost like the writer just like, I don't know, read the minds of people that have been through this because the things that happened to her, aside from like the superhero aspect of it, is all the experience of emotional abuse.
Well, when I talked to you the first time, the reason why I asked that question is when I talked to you the first time, I thought of something and I wondered if there was a show that didn't have Marvel connected to it, that didn't have a girl who was super strong, that didn't have the superpower of it. Could you do that story, take all the super heroics out of it? All those people were still victims because of the reasons that you're selling. What you're essentially saying is you don't need Kilgrave's powers to have a hold on somebody. That to me sounds like a show in its own right.
Yeah, it's really true. It's, you know, that's what my musical is about, The Gingerbread Pimp. And it's tough at first when people are reading it on paper because they're just like, what the hell is this? You know?
I saw clips of it. Explain what The Gingerbread Pimp is.
It's The Gingerbread Pimp is a musical version of my story. And
so you wrote it while you were still with him?
No, that I wrote a different musical while I was with him.
Oh, okay. All right.
When I got out of it, I thought I would just start. It was hard to open up after a while to some friends about what really went on those 8 years, and people that knew me before I had gotten married knew that I was in a terrible situation, and that I was completely unrecognizable to the person that they knew. And
so if I saw a picture of you there and I've seen a picture of you now, you look completely different?
Completely different. I looked like I belonged in a polygamous cult. He always wanted me to have really, really, really long hair and wear it down over my face. I didn't wear makeup, because if I wore makeup and somebody, you know, hit on me or smiled at me or something like that, he would say that I was sleeping with them. And so it was easier for me to just blend in and not, I never wanted anybody to look at me, or acknowledge anything good that I ever did, because it would take away from him. And it was a very tough time, because sometimes when I would be at work, I would forget that I was in that situation. I would forget that about my home life for a minute, and I would just start talking like myself. And somebody would mention, oh, you know, you're so pretty when you smile. And it would just devastate. It would just like, I would feel like I had betrayed him even when he wasn't there. And that was the part of it that was so scary, was that it just seemed like no matter what I did, no matter if I was alone or not, he was always in my head. And I was really committed to being a good wife, and I had been told in the past, when I was younger, that I was a flirt, but it was sort of like not that there was anything behind it. It was just enjoying the other person. But when I had gotten married, he was saying, you can't be like that anymore. And now as an adult, I look back and I'm like, I wasn't a flirt. I was just friendly. I just liked people. But the wake up call for me was right before he wanted to move to, well, when he had just told me that he wanted me to get pregnant and for us to move 3 hours away from everybody, I stood up to him and I said no. And it was the first time I had said no. And I started hyperventilating. I didn't realize that that's what it was. I just couldn't catch my breath. I didn't realize it was a panic attack, but I couldn't catch my breath. And he got really mad. He was like, what are you doing? And I just said, I can't breathe. And he said, get in the car. And I did, because I always did whatever he wanted. And it was 2 a.m. and we were driving along the 210 freeway in Los Angeles in complete silence. And we had come to this disagreement that we were not going to see this the same way. And I don't think he ever thought that I would ever disagree with him. And I didn't either. It was scary. Like, words were coming out of my mouth, and it was like my brain didn't have time to catch up. It was just, I was just saying these things and saying, I need friends. I need to be with my family. I need you to not be jealous of everybody. And in my mind, I was going, you're an idiot. Stop saying that, you know? And we're driving along in the car, and I'm recounting the things that I said and kind of gauging how mad he would be. And he turned off the highway and turned into this abandoned parking lot that had a wire gate with ivy all around it. And there were no other cars there. And it was in the middle of the night. And without saying anything, he pulls the car into the middle of the parking lot, and he gets out and goes to the trunk. And the immediate thought in my mind is, he's going to kill me. And I thought about it, and I sort of put my hand on the car handle half-assedly, because I was exhausted, and I thought, okay, I'm going to have to run, but you know, he's going to outrun me. Yeah, I'm going to die. And you know what? I don't care. Do it. Do it. And he came back to the car, and I braced myself for, I don't know, I thought he was going to shoot me, but crowbar me to the head, something. And he goes, what are you doing? And I looked over and I kind of gasped. And he popped in a CD, pulled out of the parking lot, and Singing in the Rain is playing. And it wasn't a relief. It was almost a disappointment, because I didn't see how I was going to get out of that situation any other way. And when I realized that I was disappointed, or even just kind of like, oh, he's not going to kill me today, that's when I woke up and left him in the middle of the night.
I apologized. I did not mean to cut you off.
No, no, not at all. Go ahead.
No, do you think the creators, not necessarily the creators of the TV show, or it might be, maybe the creators of the TV show, or maybe the creators of the character in the beginning. I don't know a great deal of the history of Jessica Jones. Do you think they had a similar experience? It just seems like art imitating life too much.
You know, if they didn't have a similar experience, I would be so surprised. But then again, if you the scary thing about emotional abuse and manipulation is that all of us can relate a bit to the tactics that a predator uses. I am in marketing. My day job is as a marketer, and I am very aware of the way that the media or companies manipulate the general public to do what they want them to do. And it's to persuade people. And the way that you go about this a lot of the times as a marketer, by making people feel like they know more than they do, or that they're smart, or that they, you know, you sort of make them feel good, but it's to put them over to a product, or to, you know, to systematically get them to join your email funnel. You know, you give them something for free, and then they have to sign up, and then after that they have to pay. You know, so it's as in business, you're always three steps ahead in terms of the psychological component to winning a customer. Or sometimes, you know, you'll see a parent that manipulates a child by showing either pleasure or disdain for what the child is doing, and it helps them grow into a good human based on depending on who the parent is.
Right.
But you see these little manipulations in everyday life. You know, a guy that lies a little bit on a first date to get the girl to come back, you know, and he's just trying to put his best foot forward, and then, you know, he locks her in later, or women too, they do the same thing. In fact, they do it a lot. And going back to your question about the support group, that was the thing. It was that nobody is immune to emotional abuse based on their, you know, demographic. It depends on if you're at a vulnerable part in your life. That's where predators can get you. One of the things that people said to me when I got out was, you're white and you're, you know, you have a nice family and you are successful, and you let this happen to you. And I said, I don't understand why people keep saying that, because they think you have to be poor or, you know, of a different ethnicity, which I find ridiculous, for this to happen, when it's such a human thing.
I mean, it's fascinating. Wow. This is one of the more unique interviews I've ever done. Now let's talk about the show in general, because I want to know how you said you related to the Hope character. You said you related to the support group in some ways, and then you related to the Jessica Jones character. I don't want to go to the end. I want to go kind of to the beginning. When she obsesses about him, did it seem unnatural because you hadn't seen him in all his glory? She starts obsessing about him before you ever see any of the really bad, awful things that he does. You know what I mean? So it's like she's making this villain out to be a villain. And, you know, as somebody who watches a lot of superhero stuff, she kind of overdoes it. Does it all kind of add up into saying, wow, this all makes a lot of sense? Or does Hope killing her parents just kind of open Pandora's box, for lack of a better phrase?
You know, I wish I had been able to watch it under eyes of somebody that hasn't been through it, because maybe I would feel the way that you feel, where it's just like, whoa, I haven't even seen what he does except these flashes of him, you know, like licking her face or like violating her in some way. You know that it's bad, but that the part of it that was missing for me, and I think they alluded to it, but they didn't really go there, is that even after you leave, when you have been in somebody's space, whether you know that they're abusing you or not, and you have come to love them, whether or not that's healthy or not, there's a long time afterwards where you are still in love with them, and or not, maybe even not in love with them, but that you still love them, and you wonder if you were crazy for leaving. Even after all of the terrible things, you go, well, maybe I exaggerated that, or maybe I imagined that. I didn't see with Jessica okay. any kind of love, but then again, you know.
Yeah, I mean, her backstory is not a pleasant one. I mean, she had other issues, you know, not just this. The character that I also I assimilated myself to was Malcolm, the neighbor, because what Kilgrave eventually forced him to become was a junkie.
Yeah.
And then the chemical aspect of being a junkie, he couldn't get off it even when he wasn't being controlled. That's remarkable. I found the originality of that kind of a victim. That's more so, you know, the upstairs neighbor that eventually gets killed, and you know the sister, I guess, and that kooky relationship. That whole thing, that's comic booky. Malcolm wasn't. Malcolm was different to me.
He was, and the actor beautifully played that part. He really, with that scene where she asks him to give up the drugs, or you know, for her, like because she basically put herself on the line to save him. And you know, the sad thing about Malcolm is that he was a person that really wanted to do good for people and was forced to hurt people. And the pain and the agony of that, and the remorse. It was something that really hit me too, because, you know, good people do bad things sometimes because they're pushed. I mean, we can talk about societies of poverty that where certain minorities have been set up for failure by the country and the way that everything's evolved. And you wonder why the crime rate is so much higher in certain areas. It's because they've been set up. They're homeless. They're starving. They're, you know, that I recently interviewed this wonderful man who set up this place called Cafe Momentum, where he takes kids that have been in juvenile hall, and he gives them a job in a restaurant and a place to live as part of their rehabilitation, and gives them these job skills. And what he's saying is, you know, these kids are labeled as criminals when they're dealing with a racial bias. Poverty, so many of them are homeless, so they commit the crimes in order to get what they need to live, and then they're put in juvenile hall, and then they go back so that because it's the only place that they can eat. Good people do bad things, and that's what's so devastating about Malcolm, is that when you're that way inclined and you wanted to devote your life to helping people, I can't even imagine, you know, coping with what you've done, whether you've been pushed to do that or not.
Okay, so then take this one step further. You know, we mentioned Hope from the beginning. Hope comes back into the show. She eventually, I thought it was a very smart way to extend the show, because they couldn't kill Kilgrave early because he needed to give proof that Hope didn't, you know, intentionally kill her parents to get her out of jail. She gets out of jail, and then he kidnaps her again. That's that scene in the bar where all the support group is standing on the top of the bar, which I'm flipping out at that time, and Hope sees no way out. Hope saw at that point, I can't do this anymore. I don't know. What was your reaction to that scene? I want Hope to have the happy ending. She doesn't get it.
Mm-mm. And spoilers. The reaction is, unfortunately, I know too many people in that situation, and they'll never get out of it. The way that I relate to Jessica, the way that I relate to Jessica is that I didn't want to tell my story in a lot of ways. After I kind of got happy, like, I didn't want to go back into talking about domestic abuse and emotional abuse, because I had grown past it and I was out of it. And I looked at my lovely New York apartment. I'm not poor anymore. Beautiful New York apartment and wonderful, wonderful partner. And we have pictures of our family and trips that we've taken and, you know, all over our house. And it's this very safe place. And I had this conversation with my boyfriend right after I saw Jessica Jones. And I, you know, because my friend had asked me to write about this before you and I were talking. And I said to David, I don't want to, you know what, it's cool. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to go back into that world. We have this very nice life. And you know, sometimes when I was doing the musical, I'd come home and I'd be weird because it put me in this weird emotional place. And, you know, I don't want to do that to you or us or, you know. And he's had to listen to me talk about my ex-husband in this way for a very, very long time, being my partner. And he's been so supportive and loving, and the opposite, not totally not jealous, totally, you know, for what I'm doing. And he said, we're stronger than that. He goes, we're going to be here. He goes, you need to see it through. And you wrote this musical, you wrote this piece. It's important to you. There's other people out there that need to hear this because they're not where you are. They're not on the other side of it. And being another voice that can lead them in the right direction is, might just be what some of them need. And he goes, so, you know, write the piece. Talk to Seth. So, that was the thing, is that Hope, you know, that the Jessica in the beginning, she wanted to run away from Hope. She wanted to get as far away from him as possible. Even though she saw this young girl suffering, and that was ultimately, Patsy reminded her, the same way David reminded me, that it's not just about you. There are other people that if you got out, you need to help them in whatever way that you can, which is why I work a lot with the domestic abuse community. And I write about it on the Huffington Post, and you know, and I'm open about my story, even when it is painful, or even when I feel stupid, like, oh my gosh, I got myself in this situation, and people are going to think what they think about me. But there's so many girls like Hope that don't get out. You know, they don't have a family. Yeah. They don't have resources. They don't have a job.
It's a great actress. Great actress too. It's just,
amazing.
It was just such
amazing. Yeah.
Just amazing. Your partner that you keep referencing, he has a name. He's an actor. So are you comfortable telling everybody who he is? And do I get to have him on the show when the Luke Cage series comes out?
sure. is David St. Louis. He is a Broadway actor. He is right now doing Sweeney Todd. He's playing Sweeney Todd at a regional theater. So he's left today. But he actually helped me workshop the musical when we were doing it. And people thought, you know, isn't this weird? He's your boyfriend. And, you know, isn't it weird that he's reading the lines of things that your ex-husband did, like that car scene starts off the show where she thinks she's going to die. And I said, no, he's absolutely the right person to help me with this because of all the love and support is I know that I'm in those times where I was feeling weak. I knew that I had that support from him. And so, you know, I feel like I watch Jessica Jones and I go, you know, I envy that writer so much because I go, oh, you nailed it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's a really big topic and a really, really complex topic. But yeah, people, I believe, underestimate emotional abuse because the thing about it is that for me, if he had hit me, I would have understood that I was being abused. Because I thought, oh, that's the only way that somebody can be abused. And I would have left. I even had one of my friends tell me, she was sort of shaking me out of it. And she said, I wish he had hit you really, really, really hard because you would have left a long time ago. But the emotional scars take a long time to heal. And that's what's so, that's why I'm glad that they've brought this to the public. And David Tennant plays it beautifully because he's so engaging and he's good looking and he's, you know, it reminded me of a conversation that I had with a psychologist. I'm friends with this psychologist who deals with serial killers, and she is my best friend's mother, and so she's watched me grow up and knew that I went through this, but she's sort of, you know, kind of dry. She's not, you know, she doesn't coddle me or anything like that. She just goes, oh, well, sorry that you got into that situation. That sucks. And then I was over at her house one night and she said, let's not watch Bridesmaids. Let's read your musical. Let me be an actor. I want to read your musical. And so I said, okay. So I made the different, you know, I made her and my friend the characters and everything. And the musical is funny. Like, it's a dark comedy. It's not, it mostly makes fun of the girl because it's me making fun of myself in a lot of ways. And, but I explain it the way that it happens. And halfway through, my friend's mom, who's the psychologist that hears terrible things every day, she starts crying. And she goes, Molly, is this true? And I said, well, we didn't sing and dance, but yeah, other than that, it's true. Nice. And she just said, this is fucked up. And that hit me really hard because she doesn't swear and because she interviews serial killers every day. But she said, you know, your husband was born without empathy and he targeted you and, you know, you always been really sweet and forgiving, and he could sense that. And the thing is about my job, when I have to interview serial killers, those are also people that are born without emotion. So as a psychologist, I have to not show any emotion on my face, because if I do, it helps them do their job better. Nobody wants to get in the car with a psychopath. But if somebody's right, handsome and you know, charismatic and looks like they really care, those are the scary ones that you need to watch out for, because those are the ones that you don't see coming. And she's like, and that's what he did. And that messed me up for a long time because I thought, oh, I know everything, you know. I know everything and I have it together and I, you know, I know what happened and I take responsibility for it and I take responsibility for what I did. But that's the thing. You see it in politicians today. the way that they Vulcan mind meld people into doing what they want them to do. And it's a scary, scary, scary time. So yeah, David Tennant, great casting.
Yeah, great casting indeed. All right, so in kind of, you know, to kind of put a bow on this, and we could do this forever, but I want you to have some free time today. When she finds out that first she's immune, which is kind of enlightening, because she doesn't just run away, she still goes after him. The way he figures out, and this is kind of less about your story, but this is more like, I thought this was great drama. The way he figured out ways to get her by hurting people in her life, I thought that was fascinating. And then the decision she ultimately has, which is she has to kill him. Just take us through those kinds of things. The first part, obviously, the immunity I thought was kind of unique when it dawns on her that she's immune to the whole thing, but nobody else is. And then take it one step further to ultimately she has no choice. There's no arresting him. She has to kill him.
Yep. He's lost his power on her because I see that in a lot of cases that I have come across. There was this girl who had gotten out of an abusive situation, and it was, her family was really wonderful, and they finally got through to her that she needed to leave him. So they were ultimately, in the man's mind, they were the ones that took her away from him. So he targeted all of them, and the girl that I worked with was being run off the road by him. He would, if she was going to an apartment to sign a lease on the apartment, he would have called the apartment place and said, you know, very lewd things about her, or got friends of his to leave messages on the phone. Like, he tried to systematically destroy her sister's life because she was the one that took his wife away from him. And he would call her work, talk to her boss, sit, pose as like a normal person. And then once the boss was in, you know, she worked for a small business, was sort of in the conversation and wondering what was happening, he would lay out all of this false information. And again, there's so many parallels in life about that, in real life. You don't have to have superpowers for that. But I think even in my own experience, after I left, it was still difficult for me to not fall victim to people that predator people. I didn't have a wall. And so I remember there was one guy I was dating after that, though, that he started playing the same patterns that my ex-husband did. You know, he would get really jealous. Like, he would see a picture on Facebook of me and like another guy that I was friends with, quite clearly friends with, and he got just incredibly jealous and mad and yelled at me and everything. And I just said, okay, this is over. We're done. Didn't take any more after that because I went, I know what the patterns are, you know?
Right.
So I feel like that's a strong similarity between, you know, Jessica becoming immune, but then she's not immune to her people getting hurt. So he has to die.
Well, the fascinating thing about it is they want to do more with her. You know, I don't know if you know the plan. The plan originally was for Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and then this guy named Iron Fist, who is a monk, actually. And they were going to team up called the Defenders. And there's going to be some kind of threat. It's not like the Avengers, even though it takes place in the same universe, it's not the same threat because, you know, one of the things that I think these shows do a really great job, they reference the Avengers. You notice she makes a comment about the big green guy. Like, that's the Hulk. In Daredevil, which I'm not expecting you to have seen Daredevil, but in Daredevil, he talks about how rent has gone down since the big incident, which is the Avengers movie where the aliens come from outer space and the Avengers stop them. So it all takes place in the same universe. But then what happens is they were supposed to make the Defenders. The popularity of Daredevil and Jessica Jones has greenlit season two.
Oh, wow.
So now season two of Daredevil comes out, I want to say, in a couple of weeks. As a matter of fact, I believe it's the same weekend as Batman v Superman, which is genius.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, the DC movies are so different than the Marvel movies. The Marvel movies, as great as they might be, they're popcorn. They're blockbusters. Batman v Superman looks so dark and so different, and yet Netflix is going to come out with Daredevil season two the same weekend, which I find fascinating. But they've also greenlit Jessica Jones season two. They tweeted about it. I love that, and I want this podcast, by the way. I need Jessica Jones, if you're listening, because the Jessica Jones Twitter account follows me.
Oh.
I want Jessica Jones to retweet this podcast. I've never asked. I didn't ask Zack Snyder. I'm not asking any movies to tweet. I want Jessica Jones' fans to hear this conversation. And I think that the unique thing is, the point of where I'm going, because I'm going off on a bunch of tangents, and that is they could have kept him alive. He could have fled.
Yeah.
And you'd have season two.
I was shocked that he got killed, actually. Because we were folding socks watching the season finale. And both right. of us, Dave, we were
you lead
like,
a charmed life.
Whoa. Okay, well, there goes that storyline. He's dead. I wonder what's going to happen next. And then they introduce Rosario Dawson, and you know that you don't just bring Rosario Dawson on for a cameo, you know?
No, she's from Daredevil. Her character, that nurse, she's in Daredevil. It was the link. The point of Rosario Dawson was she's a character. She takes care of Matt Murdock. That's the whole thing. And so by her making the appearance, it takes place. Not only does Jessica Jones take place in the same universe, they take place in the same neighborhood. You're from New York. Hell's Kitchen is not that big.
Mm.
Hell's Kitchen is
six
blocks. A lot of crap goes on in these six blocks.
Well, we're all compacted, what? You know? We're all just...
I know. Every time I go, you know, I had to do something at the Javits Center recently, and I was at Toy Fair, and I was leaving Toy Fair, and I saw a sign that said, you know, best bagels in Hell's Kitchen, and I went, Hell's Kitchen, Matt Murdock, Jessica Jones, what's going on? Like, that's how my crazy brain works.
awesome.
But it'll be very interesting to see what they come up with for a season two because, first of all, they've gripped me. I'm in. I wonder if it has to do with a tie-in on how she got her powers. I don't know. I don't know because I can honestly say I never read Jessica Jones once. Mm. The only reason I watched Jessica Jones was because it had the Marvel logo on it. I trusted. I just said, look, Daredevil was great. I would actually argue Daredevil's a little bit better. Daredevil, for you, and you know our audience definitely knows this, the story of the blind lawyer who fights crime. And you know just because he's blind, his other senses are heightened, and that's how he does it, and he becomes the man without fear. I thought that was a little bit better. The only reason why I said that was because when I watched episode 12 of Daredevil, I canceled my plans to watch episode 13.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I give. That's the only thing I'll say is better than... Like, Jessica Jones was amazing. I just remember watching episode 12 going, I can't wait till episode 13. I don't think I was that crazy. I was in Philadelphia at a conference. A bunch of my coworkers were going out to dinner. I canceled them. I said, I can't go. And I told one person, and I said... I'm not going to lie. I have to watch Daredevil, the finale of Daredevil. I'm up to it, and I have to watch it.
I'm glad you owned up to it. That's good.
I admit that. I can't believe I just admitted it on a podcast.
And now you're going to tweet the Jessica Jones people.
But Jessica Jones, well, what happened was when Jessica Jones ended, I tweeted about it, and I mentioned them. I just said, whoever runs Jessica Jones, bravo. That's all I said was bravo. And they followed me back, and I've noticed they've like liked a bunch of my tweets. So all I'm going to say is when this show is out, if anyone listening is from the Jessica Jones crew, that would be fantastic. Like, and again, it's not because of the downloads. I'm not looking for 100,000 downloads. That's not my point. My point is, I think this is an inspirational conversation. I just think that there are people listening in the audience that are watching Jessica Jones that don't relate, but there are people that also do relate, like you related. And that's where I found the fascinating thing. When you and I talked off the air, I couldn't wait to do the show. The only reason why we waited to do the show is because you had only seen three episodes.
Yeah, because it was hard to – in the beginning, right. it was hard to watch, even though it was you know, it's very well done. But it was because it was so well done, it was difficult to watch. And to be honest, like I said, I didn't think that it was going to hit me like that. I studied emotional abuse. I've worked with victims and survivors and, you know, people that didn't survive, people that died because, you know, it crossed over into physical abuse. And I thought, surely this is not going to hit me. I know that it's coming, but it did. And I'm really grateful that they are shedding light on this subject. I feel like it's kind of impossible for them not to note that this has, you know, a correlation in real life. I can't imagine that it is strictly just a superhero story without somebody really having it in the back of their mind that this is about emotional violence. So thank you, Jessica Jones people. I think you're doing good for a lot of people.
Well, and they have a lot of properties. You know, we've done podcasts in the past about, you know, they also have on ABC, they have the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And Agent Carter, I think is a great show. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I complain about a lot. And I just say my public stance has always been, you created Jessica Jones. What are you doing with the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? Like, enough of this, these people. Just give me more of that.
Right.
And Netflix is really fascinating in that there's a certain audience for Netflix. Even comedies on Netflix, you don't know where they're going. I just saw that show Master of None. And literally the twists and turns that you go, I just find network television to be a little bit more predictable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just think the only way to go through those kind of boundaries, because, you know, up until Deadpool, there was never a rated R superhero.
I love that movie, by the way.
Deadpool, it's hysterical.
That was awesome.
It's a hysterical movie. But Deadpool, you know, people say, that, oh, it's going to open the door for rated R comic book movies. I don't think it is. I don't think comic book companies want to make movies that kids can't see. No kid can see Jessica Jones. No kid is going to know who Jessica Jones is. I would make sure Jessica Jones is shown in colleges. I want women to see that. I want young girls to, like, that's what I meant by the whole thing about the tweet. I want people to see this. I think that there's some kind of empowerment from it, and that's why the title is, you know, how can Jessica Jones be an inspiration? She can be an inspiration. Listen to Molly Reynolds.
She definitely should be an inspiration, especially to college-age girls, because that's generally when it happens, because you're at that time in your life where you think you know everything, but you're starting to realize that maybe you don't, and so you're vulnerable about it. And that's usually when they get you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's pretty remarkable. Molly, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
How can people find you on the internet? They're listening to this. They want to know more about your story. What's the best way they can reach you?
You can reach me on Twitter at @Molly_Reynolds1.
There you go. That's Molly Reynolds. I'm Seth Everett. Thank you so much for listening to episode 30 of the Hall of Justice. Thanks to the folks at Blog Talk Radio. Thank you to the folks at Con Radio. You can go to wizardworld.com and see a great assortment of shows from them. We've got plenty more, but could I have a better episode 30? I mean, this is as good as it gets, folks. Molly Reynolds was a superstar. I'm Seth Everett. Have a good one. We'll talk to you next time.